We have two families that I know of who are present this morning who listen to the tapes of our worship service in Montana and down in Florida, Robin and Kay Jones, who are very, very dear friends of mine and very dear friends of this church, have been with us for the past couple of Sundays, and we'll be going back home. We're glad you've been here. And Taylor and Barbara listened to the tapes up near Bozeman. They had never seen the face of the man who spoke the sermons. It seemed to me that when they met him, they recovered rather quickly and graciously. I hope when you go back home and you hear them again, it's still all right. It's not disembodied anymore. If you get a group of people together who are really interested in basic religious questions, there is a high probability that before long, one of them will say to another, "Do you believe there is a literal devil, an actual personality who does battle with God for the possession of our souls? In other words, is the devil for real?" Christianity is split. One believer says, absolutely. Another says, surely you can't be serious. And that division runs through Christian history for hundreds of years. So you can be sure that no matter on which side you find yourself, you'll have plenty of company. When I promised to talk to you about this topic, I knew that our starting point would have to be the problem of evil. Perhaps the most difficult question theologians have ever had to face. Here is the classic dilemma, and please hear it carefully. If God is totally good, then God must hate evil. If God is also omnipotent, then God has the power to prevent evil. So why does evil exist? Evil on a grand scale, as in the Holocaust, in the Oklahoma City bombing, in the atrocities of war in Serbia, Bosnia, and evil on a smaller but no less poignant scale when a father of murdered children wonders in the anguished words of Shakespeare's Macduff, "Did heaven look on and would not take their part?" Sometimes the evil is beyond comprehension. As in this report I kept in my files from a UPI story from some years ago. Cynthia Palmer, 29, and her live-in boyfriend John Lane, 36, pleaded innocent to burning to death Mrs. Palmer's 4-year-old daughter in an oven. The two, who told neighbors shortly before their arrest that they were cooking Lucifer, were arraigned Tuesday in Maine's Andrew Scoggin County Superior Court. They were arrested October 27th at their Auburn tenement apartment. Angela Palmer was found stuffed in the electric oven. The door was jammed shut with a chair. Do you need a moment to imagine the screams of a little 4-year-old girl as the heat starts to build and she kicks wildly to get out? We don't have to debate the reality of evil on the streets, in homes, on daily television, We hear about it every day. Once more, the theological problem, simply put, is this. If God is all-powerful, then God is ultimately responsible for everything that happens in the world. Forgive me for making sure you understand what I'm saying. If I have the power to keep you from starving, and I let you starve when you beg for food, I have a responsibility for your death. The logic is irrefutable, but it is an intolerable idea for believers when it is applied to God. So it occurred at a certain moment in the history of religion that if God is good, another source would have to be found for everything profoundly evil in human life. It's possible, I think, to pin down that moment in history, but I would like to wait to do it until next Sunday, when we will trace the evolution of the devil concept through Jewish and Christian literature. Today's remarks are a kind of anecdotal introduction to the subject, more general and a great deal more personal than we will be next week. As I thought about belief in a literal devil, I recalled some moments in my own intellectual and emotional life. The night, for example, when I visited three women in the same hospital, one of them, well past 80, was recovering from a heart attack and eager to get back home to her husband and her hobbies. Another was a courageous woman of about 50 who was fighting a losing battle with cancer and knew it, but said quietly that she could handle what was coming, and then dismissed herself as a topic of conversation and went on to be concerned about other people she and I knew. The third person was a younger woman whose words that night still haunt my memory. When I walked into her room, she had the blankets pulled up right under her chin, although it seemed quite warm. I managed a wonderfully creative way of opening our conversation. "Are you cold?" She said yes, that she was cold because she was afraid. What was she afraid of? Well, she said she was afraid of the devil because he was after her. How did she know this? I tried to ask gently. And she said, "I've seen him." I asked if she meant lately, and she said, at various times in her life, but yes, a couple of times just recently, she had seen his shadow, she had seen his cloak, she had felt him pass near her. Sometimes, she said with a shudder and with absolute sincerity, "I'm just sure he is inside me." I talked to her for an hour because I thought her situation was desperate, but I'm afraid I didn't accomplish very much. She wanted to know if I believed that there were demons, and I had to say that I did not. "What about the devil?" she asked, and I said I didn't believe in a literal devil either. I tried to explain why, but a hospital room is not the best place for dealing with complex theology, so I suggested it might be more useful if we talked about it when she was feeling better. I did try to probe her past, to find out where her fears came from, and I explained that I too had once been sure I had seen the devil. Several times when I was a little boy, I was absolutely positive that he was crouching down in a dark corner just to the left of the foot of my bed. I was terrified, and like her, I pulled the covers over my head. I don't remember how long that lasted, but I think I know how it got started. I know this will surprise some of you, but I was not always an easy child for my mother to handle. So sometimes, in desperation, she would say offhandedly that the devil was going to get me if I didn't behave. Now, my mother, if you ask her if she believed in the devil, would say yes, because things are written in the New Testament about the devil, and she would not know why the New Testament would say such things unless they were quite literally true. But her conviction was actually rather shallow, something she had bought into from sermons rather than something she felt deeply. She did not blame the devil when we had bad luck or sickness. She did not even blame the devil for horrendous evil in the world. She simply paid lip service to what she had heard all her life from the pulpit. And that's why, at the end of her patience, she could so casually enlist the devil's help in managing her son. She was not serious. The idea of a devil struck no real terror into her emotional life, so she did not realize what it might do to mine. But at age 10, it was not just a theory to me. I had an extremely vivid imagination, which suggested to me that if there is a devil, he has a shape, or maybe a dark shapelessness, which is even worse, so that I created a devil in my child's mind, scary enough to frighten me almost out of my wits a few times. Hearing me say this, the young woman in the hospital admitted that she had been involved in some churches where the devil was much talked about, and where his reality, his honest-to-goodness, literal reality, was taken for granted. I got the impression that she had built up a strong guilt complex about certain thoughts that had entered her mind, and that it helped diminish her sense of guilt to blame the devil. Blaming the devil has a long history. When we are faced with a man capable of bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City, with terrorists killing innocent Greek tourists in Egypt, with Serbian soldiers using rape as a military strategy, and with the mother of that little girl in the oven, we seem to need a metaphysical explanation. Such things, we comfort ourselves, are too horrible for human origin. Therefore, some alien force has to be responsible. There was a moment in human history when somebody, for the first time ever, took that force out of the realm of the abstract, where we're never comfortable for very long, and gave it a name and a face. Tracing that evolution, as I told you, is next week's work. But if you can't wait, I'll mention some of the best books. The literature is vaster than you could possibly believe until you start to research it. But a University of California professor named Jeffrey Burton Russell has put it together like no one else and made himself the preeminent historian of the concept of evil in modern times. In several books of splendid scholarship, he writes about Satan in early Christian tradition, about Lucifer, the devil in the Middle Ages, and about Mephistopheles, the devil in modern times. And here is still another of his books called The Prince of Darkness. Here is one called simply The Devil. The cover design, by the way, is related to the traditional view that Satan is either black or red, and so he has used both. And the books I have mentioned are all aimed at professional students, but part of the one I just held up, The Devil, is especially useful for a pulpit summary, and I'm going to share that with you next week. I went into Barnes & Noble over on Rock Road several weeks ago, and having read Elaine Pagel's wonderful book on Christian Gnosticism, and having this sermon in mind already, I saw a title that said, The Origin of Satan, and plowed eagerly through it only to find, and many reviews in religious journals have now mentioned this, that she didn't do what she promised to do at all. And the book is not about the origin of Satan, so that one is gone. Now, I'd like to go back for a moment to some of the popular concepts of the devil as I've met them in personal experience. Those of you, and this will be most of you, who grew up in more sophisticated circles than I did, may find yourselves now, for a moment, in a strange thought world. But I knew that world well in my childhood, and it still has a powerful influence over millions of people you may not have occasion to meet in your social and business lives. For example, when I was a boy in Oklahoma, I watched incredulously from my front porch one Sunday night as a group of excited, one might say hysterical, people ran out of their small Pentecostal church in pursuit of the devil. They chased him down the street, past my house, shouting his name. I couldn't see him, but it was obvious they thought he was there and that they were about to catch him. When they became convinced that he had escaped them by scrambling into a storm sewer, they knelt down at the entrance to it and threw sticks and rocks at him. Now, these were not people under a doctor's care for mental illness. These were people who would get up the next morning to pump gas, teach school, sell groceries, build houses. I have wondered if the first tiny seed of skepticism about a personal devil was planted in my young head that night. Many, many years later, I was walking across the campus at Wichita State one day with a man who was enrolled in my Bible as Literature class, and I listened as he told me how he and a childhood friend had peeked through the window of a fundamentalist church one night at people shouting amens and hallelujahs to their preacher's emotional descriptions of the devil and his work. They were watching particularly one large boy they knew who was kneeling at the altar, waving his hands in the air and shouting at the devil to get out of his life. To their amazement, he suddenly jumped up, ran toward the window where they had stood a second before, and plunged through it head first. He landed at their feet without seeming to notice or recognize them and crawled frantically under a nearby truck. When they kicked a fender and said, "What are you doing under there, George?" he yelled back that he was hiding from the devil. I have no idea how much psychological harm may have been done to George, but by the time I had children, I was determined to keep them from a faith based on that kind of hysteria. I did not minimize to them the capacity for evil of the human mind. It is, after all, from the dark pools in us that the figure of Satan has risen up in the human imagination. We are apathetic about injustice and suffering. We limit our love to those who love us back. We refuse to forgive. We poison relationships and murder reputations by wicked gossip. But instead of blaming ourselves, we find it much more comfortable to blame a source of evil outside ourselves. Or as the Jewish scholar and teacher Ben Sira put it so well in a book written 180 years before Christ, listen, when an ungodly man curses Satan, what he is really cursing is his own self. I can't imagine a better springboard than those words for what we will consider next week. So please think about them once or twice over the next few days and come back on Sunday to hear about the curious evolution of Satan in Jewish and Christian thought. And if that invitation needs a little help, our music director, Mr. Bob Scott, has provided it. He tells me that the Lawrence Woodwind Quintet, composed of WSU faculty and Wichita Symphony artists, will stand in for the choir next Sunday in a very special musical treat. They are not aware that they are sharing the morning's program with the devil, but we think they would come anyway. Please do the same.